The Destiny Foundation presents Rabbi Beryl Wein's Travels Through Jewish History. This, the 98th tape in the series, is entitled Moses, Joshua, and the Conquest of Palestine, delivered in 1988. We hope you enjoy.
Tonight's lecture is on Moses and Joshua and the conquest of the land of Israel, and then the land of Canaan. It's really a very large subject to deal with in a relatively short period of time. It's hard to compress what is essentially 54 years into 54 minutes. But in my usual brilliant way, I'm going to do so. The most outstanding figure in Jewish history and world history is Moshe Rabbeinu. The most extraordinary human being. Our rabbis tell us on the phrase "Vatechasrei Umat Melokim," the verse that appears in Tanakh, that there was a human being that was a little less than God. The human being that's a little less than godliness, so to speak, is Moshe Rabbeinu. If there are 50 avenues of wisdom, Moshe Rabbeinu was the master of 49 of them. And the Chumash itself, the five books of Moshe, end with the description of Moshe that there never arose amongst the Jewish people anyone that was the equal of Moshe. Asher Yado Hashem Ponim Al Ponim, God knew Moshe face to face, however we'll interpret that. Moshe's conversation, so to speak, in heaven with God were not those of any other prophet. All the other prophets, upon the moment of revelation, upon the moment of prophecy, so they lost their human qualities. In essence, they went into a catatonic trance. Moshe, on the other hand, is kasher yadaber ish el reyu, as one man would speak to another man in a conversation. That's how Moshe dealt in heaven. V'chol beisi namonhu, in my entire house, God says, Moshe is my trustee. He can go wherever he wants, he can come, he can say, he can do. Moshe is a difference not just in degree, Moshe is a difference in kind. And therefore it's very difficult for us to assess him simply because of the fact that we have no basis of comparing him to anyone else. When we compare, for instance, political leaders, so we can say that Churchill or Lincoln or Washington was a great political leader, and you compare him to lesser political leaders. But Moshe is not to be thought of in those terms. Moshe is incomparable, and because of that, he becomes almost indescribable. Nevertheless, the Chumash does give us insights into Moshe. And those insights are important because our rabbis always felt that the life of Moshe was after all the first rabbi of the Jewish people. And the incidents that occurred to Moshe in his lifetime and his experiences with the people of Israel, in fact, the entire experience of the 40 years in the desert, all was meant to portray not only what was, but what will be. Not only what happened, but what will happen, what you can expect to happen. And the primer, so to speak, Rabbinics 101, is the Chumash. If you see what Moshe had to put up with, so then you know what you're going to have to put up with. If you see the relation, the tension between Moshe and the people, then that's the relation, the tension always between Jewish leaders and the Jewish people. And by having an intelligent and the sophisticated view of the matter, it can save a person a great deal of heartache, a great many false illusions, and can make, I think, the leader much more effective than otherwise. Now, the first thing that's outstanding about Moshe is, first of all, that he existed. Moshe is a miraculous child. Now, that's a lesson by itself. The lesson is that the Jewish people are not supposed to be here. That's the given. The given is that there should be no Jewish people. and therefore there should be no Jewish leadership. There should not be any of the things that exist that we take for granted. And the Torah, to point that out to us, tells us that Moshe was thrown into the Nile when he was a baby, when he was an infant, a few months old. And the Nile, either he would have drowned in the Nile, or the crocodiles would have eaten him, as was the fate, unfortunately, of so many Jewish children of the time. And Moshe is saved. He's miraculously saved. He's saved by the most unlikely hero imaginable. He's saved by the daughter of the Pharaoh, who himself proclaimed the decree to drown the Jewish children, to throw them into the Nile. And our rabbis describe his salvation, that she stretched forth her arm and that she was almost 20 yards away from the shore of the Nile. So if you stretch forth your arm, no matter what type of boarding house reach you may have, you cannot reach 20 yards. But God saw that she stretched forth her hand, which is another lesson. The lesson is that a human being has to try his or her utmost. If one does not stretch forth his hand, even in a useless attempt, then one cannot expect that God will perform a miracle for him. We have to do what we can do to the ultimate that we can do. And then after that, so then the Talmud tells us her hand suddenly became long. Her hand reached, and she was able to save the child. Moshe Rabbeinu's sister is present. Miriam accompanied the little cradle in the water to see what would happen to him. Now, why did Miriam do that? Again, in the theme of miracles, we have to understand what happened here. Moshe Rabbeinu should never have been born. Our rabbis tell us that on the verse in the Chumash, it says, Vayelech ish mi beis Levi, vayikach es bas Levi. A man from the house of Levi, Amram, Moshe's father, went forth and took as his wife Yocheved, Moshe's mother. So our rabbis say that the word vayikach, that he took her, means that she had once been his wife, he had divorced her or sent her away, and now he remarried her. Our rabbis say that what happened was that in the time of terrible tragedy, in the time when Jewish children were taken and thrown in the river, in the time when Jewish children were taken and mortared into the bricks, so Amram said he's not going to be married. He doesn't want to have any children. Who wants to bring Jewish children into such a world? How can one take the responsibility to bring children into the world when those children will be taken and used instead of bricks and stones? So he stood and he divorced his wife. He sent away Yocheved. He separated from her. And since he was the leader of the Jewish people, he was a person of importance and of note. So many Jews emulated him. And in effect, Pharaoh's decree was about to come true through Jewish cooperation, which is always what happens in the world. The non-Jewish world never has the power to destroy us without Jewish help. And that's been true from the beginning of time, from the story that I tell you now, through today's incidents. Without Jewish help, the non-Jewish world has almost no power over us. And what happened was that since the Jewish people decided not to have children, so you had zero population growth at its ultimate. And Miriam, Moshe's sister, took it upon herself, so to speak, to reprimand her father and mother and to say to him that what you're doing is far worse than what Paro is doing. Paro, at least, allowed the Jewish girls to live. There's hope yet. And you're destroying everybody. You're committing national self-destruction. And Amram took to heart what his daughter had to say. All fathers have a soft spot for the admonition of daughters. He took to heart what she had to say. And because of that, he remarried Yocheved. That remarriage produced Moshe. Moshe is born out of that second union, so to speak. So she saw in Moshe that he was miraculous. He was a special child. He was given by God. And therefore she could not for a moment imagine that he would be lost in the tide of the Nile, that nothing would remain of him, that after all of this struggle, that he should just evaporate. And therefore the daughter of Paro gives the small child Moshe to his true mother, who nurses him. And when he becomes old enough, when he is weaned, he is raised in the palace of Pharaoh. There are two different traditions. One tradition was that Moshe was raised until the age of 20. The majority tradition is that Moshe was raised until the age of 40 in the house of Pharaoh. And he was a prince of Egypt. He had a good education, an Egyptian education. He attended Memphis University. And Moshe was a prince, and he had all the rights of a prince, and he dressed like it, and he had the aura. A rabbi say Moshe was an enormously imposing figure, very tall, and very big, and also very handsome. He had one impediment, and that is that he did not speak clearly, which has remained a tradition among rabbis till today. Our rabbis tell us that he acquired that impediment when, as a young child, he put hot coals to his lips and burned his lips and his tongue in such a way that for the rest of his life he was never comfortable speaking publicly, which is also a remarkable insight into Moshe, because the Chumash wants to come to tell us that Moshe's greatness was not that he was a great preacher, rabble-rouser. You know, there are people that could sell you anything. You just let them start. There are demagogic people around. The acceptance of the Jewish people of the Torah and the acceptance of the Jewish people of their role in civilization was not based upon a demagogue. It was not based upon a great orator. Great person, great personality, but not in the gift of oratory. Because the gift of oratory, as we have seen in our time, many times can be misplaced. Anyone who has heard Hitler's speeches and the ability to move an audience, to move hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people by the spoken word, it's a frightening power. But it can be used for evil. It is not purely a blessing. Moshe didn't have that. But Moshe had great physical strength and appearance. And the Chumash tells it, as it does in its understated fashion, that Moshe goes out one day. Moshe finds out he is Jewish. Basia, his mother, Basia, the daughter of Paro, who was his foster mother, and whose name has remained a Jewish name. She's some interesting. Among the Egyptians, she is undoubtedly not remembered. The Egyptian books erase the whole story. The story of the Jewish people and the Exodus and Moshe, all of that is erased from Egyptian history because it's not complementary to them. And we know that history can be rewritten. Russia now has got to rewrite the history and put Bukharin in, and all the guys that they killed 40 years ago, they rehabilitated them now. Of course, it's a little benefit to them, but posthumously they are all going to go back in the encyclopedia now. But until now, they all were out. Well, history is written that way. And it depends who's in power when the history is written. It can be very, very self-serving. Well, Egyptian history was very self-serving, and they never recorded in Egyptian history defeats, disasters, like until our time, for instance, a plane never crashed in the Soviet Union, or if it did, you never heard about it. Only lately, as part of the new face towards the West, so they admit that they can have problems as well. But the Egyptians never admitted they had problems. And therefore, the daughter of Paro and Moshe don't appear in the history book whatsoever. So people say, then how can we believe the Chumash? You know, we have no independent verification. Well, the Jewish people are independent verification. You have millions of people over thousands of years that all know the same story. That's very, very good independent verification. The fact that the Egyptian records don't record it, so the Russian records don't record it, there are many southern history books that... I remember that I was in college once, and I had a professor for history who was a southerner. And the Battle of Shiloh in the Civil War, which was a Confederate victory that almost destroyed General Grant's army, just saved it at the last moment. So the one side called it the Battle of Shiloh, and the other side called it the Battle of Pittsburgh Landing. And he kept on saying the Battle of Pittsburgh Landing, and nobody in the class knew what he was talking about because we all had read the book on the Battle of Shiloh. And so somebody finally had the temerity to raise their hand and tell him, we read the book on the Battle of Shiloh. Well, you mentioned Shiloh to him, and he just had a fit. He just exploded because you called it by the name that the enemy called it and not the true name that he had it. So it's very possible that... names get lost. Names get changed. It's all on the bias of the recorder. Well, the recorder here of Egyptian history struck the daughter of Pharaoh from the book. But the Jewish people remembered her. They remembered her name. Every Jewish child that's called Batya is named after her. It's an enormous gift of preserving history. Where would we have gotten that name from? And it's a gift that the Jews confer upon those who deserve it, that they are remembered in history. For instance, that's how Alexander became a Jewish name, because Alexander the Great spared the Jewish people. But there are names that will never become Jewish. Funny people, the Jewish people. So Moses at 40 goes out. He knows he's Jewish. He sees the slavery of the Jewish people. He sees the oppression. He is so overwhelmed by the injustice that in a fit of rage, and Maimonides says, the Rambam says that Moshe's weakest character trait, if one can say such a thing, but the Rambam says it, is that Moshe had a quick temper. We see it throughout the Chumash. And that, in fact, he says that was the cause of Moshe's hitting the rock and not speaking to the rock at the waters of Meribah. And that Moshe was punished not for his action, he was punished for his characteristic of anger. Because when a person is brought to anger, then a person loses control. And the Rambam, in his famous discourse upon human characteristics, says that every trait a person should have in moderation. One should not be greedy and one should not be miserly. One should not be giddy with laughter nor always morose with depression. The golden rule is the middle, he says, except in anger. Two things, anger and humility. Arrogance. There, he said, there is no middle. A little angry is too angry. And a little arrogant is, like a little pregnant. Leads to difficulties. It's not a situation that's controllable. So Moshe, the characteristic that's shown to us is the characteristic of anger. That's his weakness. And in a fit of anger, he kills the Egyptian. justifiably so. But he kills him. And when he kills him, he is reported by Jews. Jews inform against him. That's part of the joy of doing something good for the Jewish people. There always are people that write letters to the op-ed page of the Times. Didn't begin now. You can be certain of that. And in the interest of law and order, that how dare he kill that poor Egyptian? So Moshe is pursued by the Pharaoh, who sees him for the dangerous enemy that he is. And Moshe is forced to flee. Now, according to Jewish tradition, Moshe lived for 40 years in the Middle East and in Africa. And that he was a king of certain tribes. Today we would say he was a consultant. He lent his talents to many. And he bided his time waiting to return to Egypt. He had to wait till the Pharaoh died. He had to wait till the entire matter blew over. According to most of rabbinic tradition, when Moshe comes back, nobody knows him as the killer, with the exception of the Jewish people. And this time the Jewish people keep quiet. But it is a blackmail threat that is always held over Moshe's head, and that he always feels. Moshe eventually comes to Midian, and according to most chronology, it was in his 72nd year, in other words, 8 years before he came back to Egypt. He comes to Midian, he meets Tzipora at the well. Her father, Yisro, sees a good catch when he knows one, and the wedding is made. Interesting insight, the rabbis say, though. The rabbis are just frighteningly unerring in their commentaries. The daughters of Yisro said to their father, Ish Mitzri Hitzilonu, an Egyptian saved us. Because they had there a difficulty at the well with the other shepherds, and Moshe came and saved them. So they said, an Egyptian saved us. And Moshe heard them say, an Egyptian saved us. And he kept quiet. That was his cover, that he was an Egyptian. So our rabbis say that that's why Moshe didn't come to the land of Israel. It says, Yosef Shehoda Be'artso, Joseph, when he was taken as a slave to Egypt, always said that he was a Hebrew. Vishom itonu nar eved ivri, the Sarat Abochim said. The chief of the jail said that the Sarah Mashkim. He said there was a Jew in jail with us. He said he was Jewish. So he who admitted, so Joseph's bones were taken and carried for the entire 40 years and brought to burial in the Holy Land. Moshe Shekofar Be'artso, Moshe who let them say that he was an Egyptian. So it isn't that he said it, he just let them say it. Terrible measure how God listens to us, how God judges us. The greater the person, the greater the judgment. By us it would be a minor incident at most. It would probably not even affect the balance scale. But by Moshe, Moshe should have got up and said, no, I'm not a Mitzri. I'm not an Egyptian. And we see that that lesson was learned by later prophets. When the prophet Jonah is trapped on the boat in the middle of the hurricane, and they're looking for somebody to throw overboard, and they ask him who you are and where you're from, so he said, Ivri Onochi, I'm a Jew. So Elohim and the Lord who created the heaven and the earth, he is the one that I worship. Now if you want to throw me overboard, throw me overboard. And that strength that remained within Jews, I've mentioned it to you a number of times, this book by Martin Gilbert on the Holocaust, he has there numerous stories of Jews who could have saved themselves, who perhaps should have saved themselves, who could have passed as Aryans, and who when the moment came said, no, they're Jewish. Take me too. So there's a tremendous heroic quality to that as well. And then Moshe becomes a shepherd. Like all good Jewish husbands, he goes to work for his father-in-law in the family business, which he's going to inherit. And he's shepherding his father-in-law's flock when he comes across the burning bush. And at that encounter with God, Moshe reaches the pinnacle of his life. He reaches the purpose of his existence. And there God reveals himself to him. Moshe doesn't want to take the job. Moshe is a very reluctant rabbi, which is the best kind. He really doesn't want it. And he tells God, Shlach no biat tishloch, God, send you. I mean, you got plenty of guys, right? What do you need me for? But God is insistent, as he usually is. Once God gets hold of you, he doesn't let go so easily. He forces Moshe. And Moshe returns to Egypt, and he undertakes this task, a double task. The task of convincing Paro to release the Jewish people, and the task of convincing the Jewish people that they should want to be released, that they have a future, that there is waiting for them a great eternal mission, and that they have to undertake. And the Chumash tells us how Moshe prevails. But it is mainly by the force of his personality, the miracles, the plagues. We see that all of that is only temporary. Tomorrow, Paro changes his mind. Tomorrow, the Jewish people change their mind. You don't do it by miracles. Miracles are a great sideshow, but they never convinced anybody of anything. Moshe convinces them. And by the strength of character, he leads them out of Egypt. He leads them through, again, the miracles of the Red Sea. And he brings them to the mountain of Horeb, to the mountain of Sinai. And there, that's the single most important moment in human history, the revelation of God on Sinai. The Torah is given, Moshe ascends to heaven. And Moshe is caught here in the dichotomy which always exists in Jewish leadership. And on one hand, it says, Vayal Moshe El Ho'elokim, Moshe goes up to God, Moshe is in heaven, Moshe is a man of the other world. Moshe is all spirit and all holiness. But you can't lead the Jewish people if you're all spirit and all holiness. The Jewish people, they want to know why their cow doesn't give milk. They want to know why, they want to have a din Torah with their neighbor because his fence isn't high enough or it's too high. Or they want to deal with important matters. They don't want to waste their, you know, and Moshe has to be able to deal with it. And God tells Moshe, Lech Reid Elohim, Moshe, go down to the people. Your job is to be their leader. And that's really the tension that we see throughout the life of Moshe. Half of Moshe is in heaven, and half of him is on earth. And the Jewish people are a tough people. They complain about many, many things, right or wrong. I always mention it that the most illustrative example of this problem is when the Jewish people come and complain about the menu. I have that in the yeshiva on a regular basis. You know, oh, chicken again? Like, what human being eats chicken? Or yeah, hamburgers again? Or whatever again? Well, I mean, the boys are entitled to complain. Right? So at least to me, they complain about the food. To the cook, they complain about me. But here, the Jewish people complain about the menu. And in the famous description of the confrontation in the desert, So they say to Moshe, Zacharnu Esadogo, we remember, Egypt, that was, you know, they had good Chinese restaurants, and that was a neighborhood to live in. They had good, you know, you could get a good falafel there. Esakishuim, they had pickles, and watermelon, and onions, leeks, it was terrific. And Moshe just, he can't take it. He's talking to them about God and Torah and spirituality, and they're talking about pickles. That's an unbridgeable chasm. You can say, you know, I don't believe, I don't understand, you know, let's skip this Gemara, Rebbe. But when you're talking about pickles and I'm talking about eternity, there's just no way for us to have any communication. And that's part of the problem. Part of the problem. It's been our time. The problem is intensified with the materialistic importance of things that has come to life. It's very hard to speak about noble terms when the most important thing in life is your automobile or your carpet or your house or your appliance or your video. And the Chumash wants us to understand that tension. The Jewish people accept the Torah on Sinai, and the Jewish people sin immediately, a grievous sin of idolatry. Again, the difference between faith and between idolatry is literally the width of a hair. It doesn't take long to lose it. And the great Hillel said, mentioned in the Ovester of Nosson, that a person could study Torah for 20 years consecutively and become the greatest Lam in the world, and he'll forget it in a short period of time. It's like it never was. Our rabbis phrase it in their elegant fashion, that Torah and goodness is as difficult to acquire as items of gold. And they are as easy to break and are as fragile as the finest crystal. You just look at it funny and it ping and it's gone. And that is the example of the golden calf. The golden calf is also another example of the Jewish people. The Jewish people are basically a very religious people. They always have to have a religion. If they don't have Judaism, if they don't have Torah, they need a substitute. So the religion is social ethics, or the religion is liberalism, or the religion is socialism or communism, or even the religion is atheism. There's nobody as religious, as ritualistically involved as a dedicated atheist. But you have to have something. Otherwise there's an emptiness that gnaws and gives no rest. And Moshe has to contend with that. Here we see Moshe as calling forth a civil war, killing thousands of Jews to put down the rebellion of paganism. And Moshe takes the tablets of stone that God gave him, so to speak, with God's own writing upon it, and he shatters them. And the Talmud tells us on Shabbos that Moshe did that on his own. And that God, so to speak, congratulated him for doing so afterwards. He said, you did the right thing. And the implicit lesson there is that you can't have both, right? If you want to have if you want to dance around the golden calf, okay, but, you know, the Torah doesn't go in the circle. You have choices. The prophet Elijah will say that later. That's a lesson that's hard to learn. Even today it's hard to learn. Today also we like to mix things. We like homogenization. So, you know, a little paganism, a little immorality, you know, a little Torah. You know, we put it all together. It's a cabaret night at the synagogue. It's all somehow put together, and it, you know, it's not bad. And the prophet Elijah said, Ad Mosai, how long, he said, are you going to jump on both thresholds? You can't do that. If you're for Baal, then you're for Baal. If you're for God, you're for God. You can't be both. Eventually, you have to choose. And that apparently simple lesson, it repeats itself in every generation. We would like to be both. And Moshe's shattering of the tablets is meant to be the symbol of the fact that you can't be both. Moshe never lives to bring the Jewish people into the promised land. And we see that the Jewish people, even under the protection of God, are not free of war, not free of enmity. Amalek comes, Midian comes, Moab comes, Bilam comes, Sichon, Og, one war after another. Again, in 40 years, just as we have had now, in the 40 years of the Jewish state, we've had war after war without a moment's respite. The Jewish people in the desert on the way to the land of Israel for 40 years don't have a moment's respite. They don't have peace for an instant. And Moshe is the leader of the struggle. Moshe has a disciple. One of the tragedies of Moshe's life is that his children are not Moshe, which is the tragedy almost of every great leader. Because if the father is so great, then to a certain extent the child is at a disadvantage. And no matter how great the child is, he is not the father. And we see that again in Jewish history many times. Rabbeinu Avraham, the son of the Rambam, had he not been the son of the Rambam, would have been recognized as one of the greatest men in Jewish history, which he was. But he is so dwarfed by his father's gigantic stature and shadow that he ends up to be a very pale personage, so to speak. And the Gaon of Vilna had a son, Rabbeinu Avraham, also. And many, many other great people. Rarely do you find in the Tanakh or in the Talmud or in Jewish history, rarely do you find that great people are able to produce sons who somehow are able to succeed them in a fashion that is meaningful. And God is not a nepotist, so Moshe's successor will not be his children. In fact, one of the ironies of life, one of the terrible ironies of life, is that even Moshe Rabbeinu's descendants, his great-grandchild, is a priest to paganism. And he's listed in the Book of Shoftim, his story is told. We'll talk about it in a later lecture. His name is changed to protect Moshe. There's a limit, so we don't want to shame Moshe. We don't want to say it with an open mouth that he was Moshe's descendant. But he was. Nobody has any contracts. Nobody has any guarantees. The Torah is not a matter of inheritance like a field or a building. The Torah has to be earned in every generation. The Torah stays within certain families, but everybody within the family has to make an attempt. If the attempt is not made, then the Torah leaves it. And Moshe is the prime example of that. So Moshe had a disciple, Yehoshua, who is from the tribe of Ephraim. And Yehoshua is not only the devoted servant of Moshe, he becomes Moshe's alter ego. He is Moshe. That's what our rabbis meant. The Gemara in Bava Basra says that Pnei Moshe ki Pnei Chama. Moshe had the face of the sun, and Yehoshua had the face of the moon. So it means not only that Yehoshua was less than Moshe, but Yehoshua was the reflection of Moshe. Just as the moon had no source of light of its own, and it's only the reflection of the sun, so too Yehoshua is the reflection of Moshe. And our rabbis put that to us in a very convincing fashion. Our rabbis say that if the Jewish people would not have sinned, and we would not have needed the rest of the Tanakh, because most of the rest of the Tanakh here basically the words of chastisement and of narrative regarding the failures of the Jewish people, Ilmole lochotu Yisrael, if the Jewish people would not have sinned, then we would only have the five books of Moses and the book of Yoshua. The book of Yoshua is like one of the five books of Moses. It is the concluding volume, so to speak, of the books of Moshe. Because Yoshua is Moshe. And we find that that quality existed and exists between a Rebbe and a Talmud, between a teacher, a master, and his disciples in Jewish life even till today. There are some disciples who are literally their master. There are some who are not. There are some who take the knowledge, etc., but they're their own people. They're out on their own. They're individualists. Now that's one kind, not to be criticized. But there are some people who are the Rebbe. They are the teacher. To the extent that they almost mimic the voice and the motions and the habits of how their master taught and what he said and how he did it. Our rabbis emphasize that point. Our rabbis say that regarding Hillel, that he says, Shechayav Odom Lomar Bilshon Rabo. A person must always repeat it, the halacha, in the language of his Rebbe, how he heard it from his master. So the Gaon of Vilna says that Hillel means not only the same words. Hillel had as his teachers Shmaya and Aftalion. Shmaya and Aftalion were both Gerim. They were converts to Judaism. So they spoke Hebrew with an accent. And there were certain words that they couldn't pronounce correctly. And because they couldn't pronounce it correctly, and they were afraid that the words would be interpreted, so they used an elliptical form of language. They added words to make certain that what they were saying was understood. Hillel, when he repeated that halacha, repeated it exactly as he heard from his Rebbe, even though he didn't have to do it. He could have said it straight. He spoke Hebrew perfectly. He didn't have the accent. But Chayav Odom Lomar Bilshon Rabo, a person has to say it over the way he heard it from his Rebbe. A disciple is his Rebbe. He is the master. Well, that's the example of Yoshua. Yoshua is Nar Lo Yomish Mitoch Oel. He never left the tent. And the fact that he is the successor to Moshe itself is almost miraculous. Because even though he's a person of great talents, and he has enormous abilities, and he's really, Lahavdil, we could say he's a Renaissance man. Because Yoshua is a warrior, and a political leader, and a skilled negotiator, and he's the greatest scholar of his time, and he's a prophet. And nevertheless, he has almost no confidence in himself. Without Moshe, how's he going to do it? And we see throughout the book of Yoshua, and we see it even in the life of Moshe, the blessing that is given to Yoshua is Rak Chazak Ve'amatz. Be strong. You don't say that bracha to someone who is strong. Somebody that slouches, you say sit straight. Someone who has great inner doubts, is beset by insecurity. So you have to tell them, you know, be strong. And God tells it to him, and Moshe tells it to him, and the Jewish people tell it to him, and the high priest tells it to him. You look in the book of Yeshua, it's at least 10 times repeated that phrase. Rak chazak ve'amatz. Why do you have to tell that to Yeshua? Yeshua is the great man. Yeshua is the warrior that fought Amalek. Yeshua is the spy that went to the land of Israel and saw the truth and came back and gave the correct report and wasn't influenced by the other 10 spies. Yeshua is the leader of the army. He fights the 31 kings of Canaan. He defeats them. Yeshua stops the sun in the heaven in the valley of Ayalon. So what do they keep on telling him? You know, buck up. Don't give up. Rak chazak ve'amat. Because Yoshua always feels to his dying day the loneliness of Moshe not being there. He's without his teacher. He's without Moshe. He's the disciple, and doesn't see himself filling the role. Chazal tell us that in the period of mourning, when Moshe Rabbeinu died, so there were hundreds and hundreds, and one opinion is thousands of thousands, of halachas, of matters of Jewish law, and of pieces of tradition that were lost, because for 30 days they didn't learn Torah. In the time of the mourning of Moshe, the effect upon the Jewish people was so traumatic of the death of Moshe that they lost a great deal of knowledge. And Yoshua went and appealed to heaven. And he said, you know, we're missing a whole section of the Torah here that Moshe knew and we no longer know. So please tell us, give it to us again. Let's have a mini revelation. Small Torah given again. And God tells him, no, lo vashamayim, the Torah is not in heaven, it was given once, and that's it. No encores. Not going to be told to you again. And the Talmud tells us that it was restored not by Yehoshua, who was the great scholar, but by Osniel ben Kenaz, who will become the first of the Shoftim, the successor to Yehoshua. And I once heard, and I've thought of it also myself, that the insight here is that Yehoshua is powerless to restore it himself without Moshe. He's just not able to do it. He's the reflection of Moshe. He's the unit with Moshe. He's a piece of Moshe. And therefore, he cannot dare to restore Torah's Moshe without Moshe being there. Whereas Osniel ben Kenaz, who did not have that relationship, so he's able to undertake it. And we find throughout Jewish history that he who undertakes to restore Torah is more or less successful. God helps them. Abol Letahir, the Gemara says, he who comes to purify, he who comes to do good things, Messiah in law, he has divine aid. God helps him. So Osniel ben Kenaz came and he was able to do it. Moshe dies on the seventh day of Adar. A month later, in the month of Nisan, the Jewish people cross the Jordan. They ford the Jordan River. Miraculously, the Jordan splits. And they ford it near the city of Jericho. And the Jews return to their homeland after a 250-year absence. So the first time was 250 years. Second time, the Jews were away 70 years. The third time, we were away for a longer period of time. Every time we come back, it's with blood. Every time we come back, it's with sacrifice. Every time we come back, it's against the combined opposition of the whole civilized world. And the matter is never settled. It isn't, you know, it's okay, we came back, we won the war, that's it. No, that never happened. It didn't happen in the first temple, didn't happen in the second temple, and it is not happening now either. It's a long, continuous process and struggle. We have to learn to be a little more patient, tenacious, a little more realistic about how it works. So Yeshua crosses, and the city of Jericho is the great fortress city that stands in the way. If you go today to the mound in Jericho, and you see Kathleen Kenyon's excavations from the mound, it is in my opinion, one of the most moving sights in the world. You see, it's 3,500 years in front of you. You can see the fire line on the tower, the carbon mark, as to how far the fire burned. Joshua's tower. The woman, Rochav, who hid the Jewish spies, and who cooperated with the Jewish people and who converted to Judaism, so according to our rabbis, she becomes the wife of Yahushua. Again, in one of those ironic personal twists of history, of which Jewish history especially is replete with such incidents. She is Yahushua's wife. Though it's not clear, there's an opinion in the rabbis that they never had children. It's not clear whether there were ever were any descendants from Yahushua. Yahushua fights for 7 years. The Jewish people struggle to conquer the land. There are 31 different kings who unite against them. The main enemies are the Canaanites and the Hittites and all of their various factions. There's a new bully on the block, the Philistines, who live in the Gaza Strip, which has never been noted for being a good neighborhood. Always has been a place of trouble. And they are not easily moved. They are really immigrants from Crete and from Greece, from the Peloponnesian Islands, and they settle there. The Phoenicians in the north are part of the Canaanite Empire, and they are not interested that the Jews should be able to take over. What happens is that this is a 7-year struggle, and the 7-year struggle is costly and bloody. It's tiresome, and you can well imagine that there would be people who would lose hope along the way. People expect a quick victory, and not only that, they expect that the quick victory should settle all matters. For instance, if the walls of Jericho collapsed on the Sabbath after the marching around the walls, such a miracle, then one would expect that all the other Canaanite cities would say, okay, you're right, let's make peace. And instead, the next city is the same story all over again. They have to find, and none of the cities collapse. None of the cities give in. It's as though the miracle was irrelevant. It was meaningless because it doesn't change anyone's mind. It doesn't in any way soften the opposition. It doesn't make it easier for the Jewish people. But after 7 years, the country is more or less subdued. It's more subdued, but there are lots of pockets that are not. And then there comes 7 years of colonization. The 7 years when they divided up the country. You have 12 tribes. So 2.5 tribes took property east of the Jordan River. The tribe of Reuben and the tribe of Gad and half of the tribe of Manasseh. They took their inheritance in what is today the country of Jordan and the Golan Heights and part of what is Syria. The tribes of Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. Now Reuben and Gad came to Moshe and complained. They said, we have a lot of cattle. We don't want to go there. It's Israel, right? Our business interests take us here. Also, a very silly, short-sighted policy. Our rabbis say that they went into exile before any of the other tribes. You don't speak against the land of Israel. It has a very sensitive ear. Don't say it's not for me. The Jews have to be very careful about that. If you can't do anything about it, at least shut up, which is a good rule in life generally. But when it comes to the land of Israel particularly. So those were the two tribes, Reuben and Gad. The Netziv of Valojin explains to us that half of the tribe of Manasseh stayed east of the Jordan because Moshe wanted them to be a good influence on Reuben and Gad. Reuben and Gad were people that were very given over to their businesses, to cattle raising, to sheep raising. They were very materialistic. They were very interested in the practical, realistic side of life as they saw it. The tribe of Manasseh was a little more spiritual, a little more scholarly. So he said, you stay with them, you'll be a good influence. But as always, almost always happens, the good influence becomes influenced by the others. You take hot water and mix it with cold water, you get lukewarm water. Eventually, lukewarm water becomes cold water. It never becomes hot water again. And that's the problem with good and evil also. You mix the two, it ends up... The good eventually loses out. The influence doesn't last. And the half a tribe of Menashe becomes absorbed with the two tribes of Gad and Reuven. And even though they fulfilled to the letter the obligation that they gave Moses that they would be the shock troops, they would be the scouts, they would be the ones that would fight the war first, which they did, but to a great extent they are divorced from the rest of the Jewish people. And their fate is different than the rest of the Jewish people. And they suffer from it all the years of existence, as we find written in the Tanakh. The rest of the country is parceled among the other tribes. And two of the tribes assume dominance immediately. One is the tribe of Judah, the tribe of Yehuda, which was given the southern part of the country, basically centered around Hebron and Beis Lechem. And the second tribe was the tribe of Ephraim, Yoshua's own tribe, which is centered around Shechem, Nablus in the north, the lower Galilee. And these tribes were numerous, and they were powerful, and they were able to hold their own. But the other tribes had difficulty. They had difficulty. Yoshua does in retrospect, looks like a strange thing. Yoshua, before his death, disbands the great central army of the Jewish people that won the war. He disbands the united judiciary. He disbands all of the central council of the tribes. He turns it back into 12 little tribes instead of one great united country. And our rabbis seem to intimate that he did so because from now on, Yoshua was the end of Moshe, as I mentioned to you. Yoshua and Moshe carried the Jewish people. The story of the first 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years of the Jewish people is the story of Yoshua and Moshe, not the story of the Jewish people. Kasher Yisa Ha'omei Nesayonei. They carried the Jewish people the way a mother carries a nursing child. So it's their story. From now on, it's going to be the story of the Jewish people. From now on, it's up to the Jewish people. Nobody's going to carry them. They're going to be great Jews, going to be great prophets, great leaders, but the story now is the story of the Jewish people. Moshe and Yoshua are the unit. After Moshe and Yoshua, it's a different arrangement completely. A different world. And that's the world of the Tanakh that we're going to discuss. Because then it's the story of the people. And that's why our rabbis say, Yiftach bedoro kishmuel bedoro. Meaning that in his generation, Yiftach was the leader, just as Shmuel, the great Samuel, was the leader in his generation. Meaning that the leadership now is up to the generation. It's no longer a matter that God picks somebody out of the burning bush and says, you're going to go and save my people, because the Jewish people were not worthy of Moshe. He was not a true reflection of them. He was a great man, and they were illiterate slaves. And Yoshua, who is the completion of Moshe, is also far beyond the Jewish people. But from now on, you get, I always say that a congregation gets the rabbi it deserves, usually in spades. That's the way it works. That's the way the world is. Well, the hero of the story now is not going to be the individual Jew, the leader. The hero of the story is going to be the Jewish people, with its ups and downs, and its good and bad, and all of its peculiarities and difficulties and greatness, all rolled into one. And the Tanakh, which is the book of all books, will not hide any of the facts, and it will not sugarcoat any of them, and it won't cover it over, but rather it will point it out to us in all of its clarity, so that we have an understanding of the Jewish people and of their relationship to their land, and of their development in the land, until the time, at least until the monarchy takes hold, and we come to a different and newer era in Jewish life.
This concludes Lecture 98 on Moses, Joshua, and the Conquest of Palestine by Rabbi Beryl Wine. For information, please contact the Destiny Foundation at 1-800-499-WINE. That's 1-800-499-9346. We can also be reached by email at info@jewishdestiny.com. Shop online at www.rabbiwine.com. Due to copyright laws, we kindly request that there be no duplication of this lecture.